On this week's 51%, in his last days in office, former President Biden said he believes the Equal Rights Amendment is the 28th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. But is that true? We speak with Georgetown Law Professor Victoria Nurse about why the ERA has been in limbo for so long and what it would mean for American women.
What a constitutional amendment does is it prevents that kind of backsliding and offers people new ways to pursue women's rights.
I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on. I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it. I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. In his final days in office, former President Biden threw a bit of a curveball on his way out.
Today, I affirm the Equal Rights Amendment to have cleared all the necessary hurdles to be added to the U.S. Constitution now.
The ERA was first drafted more than a century ago by two leaders of the women's suffrage movement, Alice Paul and Crystal Eastman, and it would explicitly prohibit sex discrimination, guaranteeing legal equality for women and men. The last state needed to ratify it did so in 2020, but there has long been debate on its status, leading some to say the ERA is simply dead. Here to help us understand why is Victoria Nurse, the Ralph Whitworth Professor in Law at Georgetown University Law Center. Nurse is a leading scholar on Congress, the separation of powers, and statutory interpretation. In addition to her work at Georgetown, Nurse has practiced as an attorney in the Senate, the Department of Justice, and in the White House. She specifically served as counsel to Biden when he was a senator and when he was vice president during the Obama administration. So that all said, she's been a long supporter of the ERA, but she says its future is still up in the air.
The ERA was proposed in 1923, and it has a very long history. In the 70s, over 20 states ratified it. But you need 38 states, which is an awful lot of states, to ratify a constitutional amendment. That's why we have so few constitutional amendments. Many other constitutions have lots of amendments. We don't, because it's so hard. But recently, in the last 5 years, three other states have ratified and finally made it up to 38 states. And so 38 states, it should be ratified, right? Well, not so much. There have been legal arguments since the 70s and 80s about whether a part of the resolving clause, when Congress sent this to the states, Congress has to have two-thirds of each of its branches to propose a constitutional amendment. So it did that a long time ago. But in the proposing clause, it put a deadline. And so it said, whereas, you know, blah, 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 blah. And they do this for every law. And they said ratification within 7 years. That was extended in the Carter administration to 1982. And so opponents have been saying that the ERA is dead, but that assumes that deadline is actually controlling on the states and is constitutional. So there are many constitutional experts who have been pursuing this argument for some time that, in fact, the Constitution doesn't allow Congress to give deadlines because it doesn't say in there. It just says Congress will propose. And this became a lot stronger argument when, in the 90s, a Republican administration embraced an amendment that had been pending for 203 years. And so the thought was, oh, well, maybe there is something more to this. And so it's a legal fight now and a constitutional fight. Most recently, in last August, the American Bar Association, which is the largest group of lawyers in America, finally accepted this argument that the Constitution does not provide for a deadline. And by the way, even if it did, because some of our amendments have had it in the text that's ratified, this form of a deadline is not good. It's not operative because it's in like the header. It's not in the actual equal rights of women shall be respected part of the text. It's in this part that Congress writes. So it can bind Congress if Congress wants, but it can't bind the states and the nation. So that's the argument. And President Biden came out very strongly for that. And I think There were many reasons for that, which we can get into, but that gives you the background of the controversy about the deadline, and his statement endorsing the ABA's position.
I was going to ask, the statement he made, how much weight does that really carry? Does this do anything for the ERA?
Well, here's how it moves the ball forward. Presidents issue constitutional statements all the time. The current President Trump, in his last time in office, had his Justice Department write a constitutional memo saying the ERA is dead, it cannot be revived, the recent ratifications are null, and Congress cannot change the deadline in that header piece, right? And so that was very aggressively anti-ERA. That would mean if it were law, this was just an opinion from the Justice Department. It's persuasive, it doesn't bind a court. But if that opinion had just stood unanswered, then I believe the ERA was dead. And so it was very important for President Biden to come out with a very strong statement telling the Trump administration, hey, look, you're not using the right argument. You're not listening to the ABA, which is a huge organization. You're using these very bad arguments. They miss you, in my view, they miscited the cases that they were relying on. And that has a real big influence on how the Trump administration is going to go forward. They will have to respond to this because the former president's opinion stands until the new president reverses it. The second thing it will do is Congress, most people agree that Congress can change the deadline. And they were pretty close. So the House had already passed changing the deadline. The Senate's harder because you have to get 60 votes typically. But Senator Gillibrand and Senator Murkowski, a bipartisan duo, have been pushing really, really hard for this. And they're going to continue to push. And the reason that's important is because, of course, the Supreme Court of the United States. So the backstory here really is about the court and what it's done recently and what it's continuing to do based on a philosophy that takes us back to 1787 and 1868 when women had no rights. They were still basically the chattel of their parents or their father and their husband under state law. I can talk a little bit more about each of those things, but I think it has an effect on President Trump. I think it has an effect on President Trump's Justice Department. And I think that in turn will change the debate in Congress. And I know that Senator Gillibrand was delighted at President Biden's statement because rather than letting the old Trump opinion stand, he pushed back aggressively on behalf of women.
I'd like to talk a little bit about what the text of the ERA actually does and what it would mean for women in the US.
Excellent question. For years, I mean, if you're a constitutionalist, it's sort of, and my classes are probably now 56% women. It's always somewhat embarrassing to find that we're in a what I call the axis of misogyny. We're in with countries like China and Iran, where we have no protection for sex equality in our constitution. So that if you don't have it in the constitution, that means a court can decide something different, right? It means that a president or a Congress can engage in backsliding. There are certain people in the United States who've recently said they want to get rid of the women's right to vote. So what a constitutional amendment does is it prevents that kind of backsliding and offers people new ways to pursue women's rights. For example, in 2000, on a bill that I worked on, so I'm obviously biased, but I helped write the Violence Against Women Act, the original one in 1990 for Senator Biden. I was the staff drafter. And a part of that bill would have allowed you to sue your attacker, even if state law didn't permit you. And state law makes it very, very hard, and it still does. I just published another law review on that. And the Supreme Court struck it down. This was in 2000. They said women are not protected by the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. A lot of women thought they were. Why? Because in the 70s, the court had said so, but not, it turns out we're protected in our jobs. So when we're acting in commerce, we are. But outside of the job, you're really not protected. The court has justified Title IX and Title VII as things about being in commerce or education. But when it comes to your body, they held a long time ago, pregnancy itself does not give rise to equal protection arguments under the 14th Amendment. They held that in the 90s and before. And now in Dobbs, they've held that abortion, the Equal Protection Clause, does not apply to women in that context either. So they made it pretty clear. And they've changed the law from what most lawyers thought in the 70s and 80s. And that is an important backdrop to why this is important. So if you, Congress were to pass, as candidate Harris wanted, and so did former President Biden, a national codification of Roe, if they were to do that, the Supreme Court would strike it down because of its prior decision in Dobbs as precedent. The only way to give you a new argument is for the court to have something in the text of the Constitution that would create a new argument to protect that. Otherwise, you're left to the states, which is to say, you can change your state constitution. But that means we'll still have a nation divided. We'll have a nation that is pro-health care and anti-health care. And so it's not a very stable situation. One of the good things the court does is establish a national baseline. But to quote a very conservative lawyer at Harvard, who is not necessarily a pro-woman advocate, this court is engaged in disruption. And that makes the constitutional arguments a very, very difficult way to go. The one thing this court does believe in is the text of the Constitution. It says this over and over and over again. So if you were to amend the text, you'd at least have a shot to argue that their Dobbs decision was not controlling on a question of abortion.
So, is it possible that the very question of whether or not the ERA is ratified could end up at the Supreme Court?
Of course. So Biden's statement in and of itself cannot trigger a lawsuit because he didn't order anybody to do anything. A lot of people wanted him to order the archivist. She's constitutionally irrelevant. What she says is irrelevant. He's the president of the United States. He speaks on behalf of the whole public. So once he's spoken, it will be up to Trump to try to figure out how to figure out. His Justice Department, no doubt, will write a contrary opinion, but it has to be different than the last one, because the last one was not very, it didn't address any of the arguments that the ABA has made or that Biden made. But they will also, if they want to, and I'm quite sure conservative activists would like to push a lawsuit against it. To get a lawsuit on a constitutional ground, you have to have an injury, in fact. So someone has to be injured by a law. And so that has to happen before a lawsuit can be brought. So the real push here has to be in Congress, in my view. I don't think this is going to get to the court first. I think that people, if they care about this, need to work on the Senate. And that is going to become more important because I believe the court will continue to do things that I think that a supermajority of American women and men disagree with. The abortion pill decision is going to come up. Trump will push an ancient statute called the Comstock Act, and there is a good textual argument that the abortion pill is not will be criminalized. If that happens, the only way to push back is the Equal Rights Amendment. And so there will be more pressure in Congress to actually lift the date.
I guess I'm just trying to understand what the opposition is here. You know, not like the not the technicality of like, oh, we missed a deadline, but like, why has this been so difficult to get people to get on board with? You know, is there an actual legal argument here, or is it more just, I guess, you know, people not wanting women to be equal?
The opposition has always been, and this happened in the 70s. In the 70s, they say, oh, you're going to get gay rights. Oh, and that was scary at the time, you know? And so they've always picked extreme examples. So now they're focusing on transgender. Oh, this would get transgender people in sports. When I testified for the ERA in the House of Representatives a few years ago, that was the argument on behalf of conservative think tanks. That the only effect this would have, that women already are equal, which is not true. Justice Scalia said the 14th Amendment does not actually apply, and now the Supreme Court has said it four times. The Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment does not apply to women outside of commerce. So the argument is on behalf of political opponents that, first of all, they're telling you incorrect law, right? But second of all, they're telling you that it's about transgender. And it's about gay rights or gay marriage, but gay marriage already exists, so we shouldn't really be worried about that, right? And you know, they rely on some statutes like Title VII and Title IX, say, oh, you've already have that, but the problem is Title VII and Title IX don't apply outside of big organizations. So it actually eliminates all gig workers. Most people of color who run small businesses, they're not covered. The Violence Against Women Act could not be passed because, I mean, part of it, the one that would actually allow you a damage remedy, Because the court said, no, you don't have equal protection, which is really, it's stunning because the 14th Amendment, which says equal protection, was really meant equal protection from criminal behavior. That is its original meaning in 1868. No one thought it covered women, to quote Justice Scalia, because they were trying to embrace the formerly enslaved, or at least white women. There may be an argument it covered the formerly enslaved black women. But it just seems crazy that we're still arguing about this. But that's why it is the court that has really pushed us here, because the court of history will show this is all of this, kerfuffle, in my view, was the last bastion of sort of common sense anti-equality rhetoric in the 20th century. I mean, it really is stunning how this has gone. It also applies to women in the military, by the way. The court has never said women have any right to serve in the military. And so if Congress wanted to get rid of that tomorrow, they could. The only way you can prevent the legislatures of the states or the feds to do something is if the court says they'll protect you. And I think one problem here is that many people thought that the court was safe. And knowing the court over history tells you that no, they vary quite a bit. And they have followed the political winds of conservatism. There are six of them who I'm pretty sure, and they just voted for this in Dobbs, and even before that, for this six in the Morrison decision in 2000, that equal protection under the 14th Amendment, I repeat, does not cover women. So that's where we are. Abortion has made this a key fight, I think, because it energizes women. But the abortion forces need to understand that there is a very good argument that the court in the next couple of years will, in fact, bar by statute the abortion pill and cr allow the criminalization of the male of an abortion pill. I see no reason why if the court was willing to get rid of abortion, why it wouldn't read that statute that way. I have some arguments I can make, but I think that's why ERA is important. I think the president understood that. And so he wanted to make the best possible argument so that we ventilate the good arguments. And there's a lot of bad arguments that have been made. For example, the court itself has said it doesn't control constitutional amendments. That's for the people. It's for the Congress. It's for the states. Ultimately, the states determine this. So we'll see.
Victoria Nurse is the Ralph Whitworth Professor in Law at Georgetown University Law Center. She's also served as counsel to former President Biden at various points in his career and has been an attorney in the White House, the Department of Justice, the Senate, and in private practice. You can learn more about her work at law.georgetown.edu. Victoria, thanks for speaking with me today.
Thank you so much for having me, Jesse.
In the days before President Donald Trump's inauguration, the People's March drew crowds in Washington, D.C., New York City, and other communities across the country, just as its predecessor, the Women's March, did in 2017. But the vibe was a lot different this time around. I spoke with protesters at a local version of the march in Hudson, New York. Complete with their own marching band, a few hundred people paraded down Warren Street to Promenade Park in Hudson. Jessie Lurie, a member of the Rhinebeck Democratic Committee, brought what she calls her, quote, all-purpose pissed-off protest sign that she uses in every protest. She says she's marching today because it feels like her only choice.
Doing nothing's not an option. Staying home and being scared isn't an option. And we just owe it to other women to be here. We owe it to the future generation to be here. Because nobody wants to look back and say, why'd nobody do anything?
The National People's March drew thousands to Washington, D.C. ahead of Monday's inauguration, but it was still only a fraction of the crowd that turned out to protest Trump at the original Women's March in 2017. That event, with partnering marches across the country, was the largest single-day protest in the U.S. at the time. Rudy Stegemiller and Mary Lynch drove from Rensselaer County to Hudson this time around. But 8 years ago, they were in D.C.
That was one of the most joyous days of my life, honestly, because we felt like, okay, this fluky thing happened, but 500,000 people are here to make sure that nothing really bad goes. And did not anticipate that we'd be doing this 8 years later.
I am delighted to be here because after the last election, I was shocked and stunned. I understood the political realities, but I was born in 1960. I remember in the 70s becoming a feminist. I remember being proud of our country for so long, and it just seemed like a rejection of that.
That shock seems to be a common feeling in the crowd. And while it was certainly there in 2017, too, it feels a little heavier this time around. Trump won re-election decisively in November, with both the popular and electoral college vote. Speaking to protesters, you do get a sense that people are tired. Not resigned, but tired.
How is this man not making y'all want to move?
The Women's March has also changed a lot since Trump's first term. This edition is marching not just for women's rights, but for trans rights, migrant rights, racial justice, labor unions, protecting the environment, protecting libraries, and defending democracy itself. Multiple protesters point to Trump's felony conviction over hush money payments his attorney made to an adult film star before the 2016 election. The president was given a sentence of unconditional discharge with no jail time earlier this month. Others denounce his cabinet picks, with one sign simply reading, quote, "Is a competent cabinet too much to ask?"
We have a president that shouldn't be there. He was convicted. He was impeached twice.
That's Anna Parisi, a youth director with Hudson Learning Center Kite's Nest.
This whole government is trying to actually divide America, not bring it together. So when we stand here, we're standing for all of those reasons. We're standing to try to keep a little bit of our dignity and fight for what we believe in.
Tell me, what does democracy look like?
This is what democracy looks like!
Crystal Perry, a political organizer with the labor union 1199 SEIU, says the goal of the march was to remind Hudson residents about their support for one another.
Despite everything, humanity is going to always win. We can disagree, but our issues will always be our issues. And as long as we let that be the root and the foundation of why we do this, we're always going to win.
Lynch says she's not concerned by the smaller turnout in D.C. She feels they got a good crowd in Hudson, and she understands why some may have decided to sit this one out.
This is not a sprint. It's a marathon of 4 years. And for us, this was important. For other people, I know people who work in trans areas that are using this weekend to get themselves ready for the fight ahead. So everyone's going to choose different ways to resist, and that's perfectly okay.
Lastly, Cecile Richards, an abortion rights activist who was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom by Biden in November, has died at age 67. The daughter of former Texas Governor Ann Richards, Cecile Richards served as president of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America from 2006 to 2018. Following her departure from the organization, she co-founded the political action group Supermajority. To learn more about how Richards' work inspired action today, WAMC's Lucas Willard spoke with Shelley Hegan, CEO of Upper Hudson Planned Parenthood in New York.
I would say first and foremost, Cecile was an incredibly charismatic leader, and she really brought Planned Parenthood into the public space and also into view for younger supporters and more activist level supporters, where Planned Parenthood had always been a very trusted name in high quality healthcare, and we're really, really proud of that. I think under Cecile's leadership and of course the sort of beginning of these crazy times, she really recognized that it was important for us to be a voice for multiple generations of people who are affected by access to reproductive health care. And I was so grateful. She came and spoke at least once here in the Capital Region at one of our events. And she's just an incredibly inspirational coalition building leader. And that probably comes from her background in political organizing as well as labor organizing. So she was an organizer at heart. And I think that she brought that energy into our movement in a way that is still going strong.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about that. If her example at the national level of the organization did directly inspire any particular actions or programs with Upper Hudson Planned Parenthood?
I think that what Cecile did, so it's funny because I started 18 years ago at Upper Hudson Planned Parenthood, and it was the same year that Cecile started as president of the national office. I started in a HR role. I had a role under our previous leader, Pat McGowan. And I remember going to our very first meeting as a leadership team, and the Vanity Fair cover had just come out. And when Cecile was first hired at Planned Parenthood, Vanity Fair did a cover of Cecile sitting at a big sort of like old white man kind of business desk, completely covered with babies, like baby crawling all over the place. And it was just such a really, I think, a radical departure from how Planned Parenthood had presented itself for so long. Like, we are here for all kinds of women, all kinds of people making all kinds of choices about their pregnancy, including having healthy birth outcomes. And she really ushered that in. I think that has been really important to us at Upper Hudson, because we have seen it in some ways. It freed us up to see ourselves as primarily a provider of care for folks who fall between the gaps. And so that's been inspirational for us in terms of expanding our abortion access, of course. But then over time, we also expanded into gender-affirming care, and we continued to expand into behavioral health care. And now we're doing a lot more outreach around menopause care. And all of these are areas that are – all of these are types of care that are both stigmatized and marginalized and certainly not available to people who don't have money. And so I think Cecile was a real inspiration, excuse me, to us and our affiliate – to say we're Planned Parenthood, and Planned Parenthood means a lot more things than just contraception. It means that planning for your future, regardless of who you are, what color you are, where you come from, how much money you have, all of those things should not factor into your ability to pave your future for yourself. And our services are reflective of that, and they continue to grow and change as our community's needs continue to grow and change.
The Supreme Court's decision of Dobbs v. Jackson came after Cecile left Planned Parenthood as head of the national organization. How has her example and those organizing efforts that you've talked about prepared organizations like Upper Hudson Planned Parenthood for a second Trump term?
Well, that's something that I have to practice conscious breathing on when I think about it. I think that with the Dobbs ruling and what happened then, and certainly when Cecile departed from the national office, she didn't go into retirement. She started Supermajority, which was a real reaction to the first Trump administration. And it was saying we have a supermajority in this country of people who support abortion rights, and we also have a supermajority who support women's rights. And so she started that organization as a political action to encourage more people to run, to help with organizing in places that needed it the most. And then she went on to do even more work in the abortion space. So she had a whole movement called Unstoppable, I think they were called. But she really just worked at coming up with more and more ways for people to become active and sort of own the narrative in a different way. I think that what has happened at Planned Parenthood Federation is obviously one of the things that's really different about Planned Parenthood than many other feminist organizations is that we're direct care providers. And so we're struggling with the effects of Dobbs in a very specific way that's different than just a political and organizing group would have to face. So we are facing the direct challenges that this new Trump administration is going to face us with, specifically when it comes to continuing to erode access to abortion, even in places where it's currently legal and safe, like it is in New York. I think those things are all part of her legacy, and certainly Alexis McGill Johnson, who is the current president at Planned Parenthood Federation of America, takes incredibly seriously, which is how we balance our political and activist work with the day-to-day work of direct delivery of care that the affiliates do across the country. And that's not an easy balance. And we are certainly, all of us, struggling. I know here in New York, the biggest concern we have right now is funding. And, you know, we are providing a greater number of services than ever before to people who need us more than ever before. Certainly as immigrants in our country are attacked from the Trump administration, we're going to have even more people who we have to find ways to care for who are undocumented. Those challenges are very specific and actually quite, they're just sort of everyday tactical choices on how do we make sure that our doors stay open, that we're funded and at a level that allows us to maintain our staff and maintain our standard of care for everyone who needs us going into the future. That's like the real sort of concrete everyday challenge in New York. And I think that challenge is very similar in other quote unquote blue states across the country. That's different than, I would say, the activism forward leadership that Cecile provided, because we didn't have challenges at quite the same level to our everyday access to care that we're facing now when she was in her leadership position.
That was Shelley Hegan, CEO of Upper Hudson Planned Parenthood, speaking with WAMC's Lucas Willard. Thanks for joining us for this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio based in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King for 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half. He was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night and down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool, no electricity. Hot rain on the concrete, sweet.